This is podcast number 107 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm sharing the story of Edward Bach. In the Stories of Great Writers in the Forgotten Classics series on page 97 is a sweet story of a young boy's visit with the great poet Longfellow. The boy's name was Edward Bach, who was born in the Netherlands. I thought you might enjoy hearing his story that I found in a book by Mary Parkman called High Adventurers. Edward Bach was an adventurer for beauty. Here's the story. Edward Bach was not quite 7 years old when the great adventure of his life began, the adventure of turning a little Dutch boy into an all-around American. He was born in the Netherlands, that land of thrift and courage where strong dikes and untiring energy keep for men's uses the land hardly won from the sea. When he played as a tiny child by the great sea walls or watched the turning windmills that pumped water from the low stretching fields, he began to understand that the world was alive with many interesting things. In his own home, he listened to stories of high adventures of his own people. He was never tired of hearing about the rocky island where his grandfather had gone to drive away the pirates and make a place where people could live in safety and happiness. He could see the story in pictures as if one were turning the pages of a book while his grandmother told about the adventures of the strange long-ago times. 5 miles out from the Dutch shore in the North Sea was a bleak island where many ships were dashed up against the rocks in a time of storm. There, pirates, like evil birds of prey, fell upon the shipwrecked voyagers, murdered those who were able to escape the fury of the waves, and seized their goods. Edward could picture his grandfather at the time when he was a fearless young man who had already proved himself to be a success as a lawyer, standing in the presence of his king. "Your country is sending you to a dangerous island as mayor and judge," said King William. "You are not a man to run away from a hard task. We feel sure you will prove to be a leader who is not afraid of danger or hard work." It was soon clear to everyone that the king had chosen wisely. The young man brought hope and courage to the frightened people of the island. Soon all of the robbers and pirates had left a place where lawless people could no longer count on escaping punishment. The mayor judge looked about one day at the place that he now called home. What a bare, ugly land it was. No trees, no park, no gardens. The people thought that it was too cold for beautiful things to take root there. "We must make the best of it," they said. "That is what I want you to do," replied the young mayor. "Make the best of it by making gardens and planting trees." The people, however, were stubborn. "We are poor people with no time or money to spare," they said. "We will not waste the little we have on trees that cannot live through the winter storms." Their mayor answered by planting 100 trees. These were hardy pioneers that seemed to have in their sturdy growth something of the courage of the man who planted them. Each year they stretched up new branches, and each year the young leader planted more trees. The once bare island was now a place of greenness, famous for its songbirds. The Island of Nightingales, people called it. Travelers from many lands came to see the beauties of the island and listen in the evenings to the songs of the birds that had found a place of safety on that once forbidding shore. There were not only nests of thriving birds, but also a large family of healthy, happy boys and girls growing up in the home nest that the mayor had built. The days for them were full of merry play and worthwhile work. When any one of them was tempted to give up some hard thing as a bad job, he was shamed out of it by just looking around at the proof of the way one person had persevered in the hard task of making his world a better place for all who lived there. The story of the winning of the Island of Nightingales through the work of one man was told again and again. Don't forget that good work lives and grows just as trees do. Soon happy lives make their nests in places where once there was neither shelter nor safety, the grandmother would say. And then she would add, looking straight into the eager faces of the children, "Always remember that each of you must make the world better and more beautiful because you have lived in it." Edward Bach could not remember when he had first heard those words. It must have been long before he was really able to understand their meaning. They were a part of his earliest memories of summer, a time of sunlight glancing through green branches beneath which he and his brother used to play. Then everything was suddenly changed. The family fortunes were at a low ebb, and the father and mother told the boy that they must go to find a new home across the ocean, not on a little island, but in a country much larger even than Holland, the United States of America. The big steamer called the Queen landed the family in New York, a strange place where everybody spoke a language new to the two boys of 6 and 8, who, the day after a place was found in Brooklyn for them to stay, were sent to a public school. The children could not answer back when a group of lively boys plied them at recess time with questions. These boys thought it fun to see how far one could go in tormenting the newcomers. It was evident, however, that even small boys from the land of pluck could take care of themselves. We know that bullies are always cowards and quick to give way before those who have the courage to stand up for their rights. These Dutch boys were not slow in proving that they had strong bodies and quick wits, as well as a plentiful supply of grit. Pluck is understood by everyone, no matter what language happens to be spoken at the moment. Edward and William Bach showed themselves quick to learn not only the ways, but also the speech of their new country. It was not many weeks before the boys on the playground, who called Edward Dutchy, had forgotten that he was a newcomer in their midst. Life was not easy for the boy. His father had hoped that America, which had proved for many a land of opportunity, would open the way to a new wealth for one who had been so unfortunate as to lose a fortune in his native land. It is hard, however, to get a start anywhere, especially for those whose abilities and experience have been matched to conditions different from those they are forced suddenly to meet. Mr. Bach was no longer a young man, and though he had learned to speak English in the excellent schools of the Netherlands, he was unable to find the work that he was able to do. If Edward had not been the sort of boy who could find real fun in proving himself equal to hard work, he might have hated the first years of his American adventure. As it was, many times he was tired at the end of a day when, as often happened, he came home from school to help about the house. His mother was not strong enough to meet alone the many demands of the new life. She was used to Dutch cleanliness and order, but in the Dutch home there had been servants to share the drudgery. And as a good housewife who had been brought up in the ways of Dutch thrift, she often sighed and looked anxiously at her children when she saw everywhere signs of waste. "We seem to have come to a strangely reckless land," she said. "I believe all the poor of the Netherlands could be fed on what American women throw out from their kitchens. Don't forget, Edward," she added, "that the person who wins in this life is the one who learns to turn things to good account, whether on a rocky island or in a wide country rich in many of nature's gifts. People and nations gain when they use in the best way all that they have. When we waste, we lose not only an opportunity, but also something of real power in ourselves." As she spoke, there flashed before Edward's imagination the picture of an island of fair gardens and parks for rest and play. He, too, would try to make the world a better place because he lived in it. First, there was the need of earning wherever possible, for the little family could not stop eating while a newcomer from Holland was trying to make the right sort of start for success in a new world. There were chilly mornings when there was neither wood nor coal for a fire, and the two boys went out to glean pieces of wood left on vacant lots and coal that was littering the streets near sidewalks where fuel had been delivered. "It's all right for us to get what people have thrown away or wasted," argued Edward, when his mother shook her head as her two boys brought in before school a scuttle full of coal that had been collected among the neighboring streets. "This is America, where a person can do any sort of honest work." One morning, as Edward stood looking at the fresh buns in a baker's window and wondering how he could earn the money to add food to the family store, the chance came for his first real job. The baker, too, came to the shop door to admire his display. "No one could help seeing how good your things are if somebody would wash your window for you," suggested the boy. "Would you like to clean it?" asked the baker. and a bargain was made that Edward should come to the shop Tuesdays and Fridays after school to keep the shop window clear and shining for 50 cents a week. Since an opportunity well met generally opens the ways to new adventure, Edward was soon finding that the precious after-school hours might be filled with different kinds of earning and learning. The baker gave him a chance to wait on customers and take home as wages another dollar, together with some of the bread and buns that could not be sold the next day as newly baked. So, as he went about delivering a weekly newspaper, he got an idea of a way to get a job as a news gatherer. At 13, he got a job as an office boy at a telegraph office, always looking for ways for improvement and advancement. The boy did not need urging to improve the opportunities that came his way. Indeed, he was always looking ahead for new possibilities just around the corner. He knew that it was his grandfather's steady, hard work which had brought order and beauty to the Island of Nightingales. He had heard someone say that genius is at root of a great capacity for taking pains, and he believed that nothing could be won without persistent effort. Some of his precious savings were spent for an encyclopedia, which he hoped might give him a clue to the different ways that great men had worked for success. Evening after evening, he turned the pages, but somehow the living secret did not seem to be hiding between the covers of the volumes. Perhaps one of the men who had triumphed over difficulties would be willing to give a boy who had been forced to educate himself a golden hint from the riches of his experience, which would help him to go ahead in the right way. He had read in his encyclopedia that General Garfield, at that time a candidate for President of the United States, had taken the first steps of his career when, as a boy, he trudged along behind a mule on the towpath of a canal. Edward decided to write a letter to the great man and ask if the book spoke the truth in so describing the first stage of his journey in life. He would ask also for a word that might help an ambitious young Hollander to win success in his adopted country. General Garfield wrote a cordial answer, which increased the boy's interest in the biographies of great men and also gave him a new hobby. So he wrote to other great men. General Grant not only answered his question concerning Lee's surrender, but enclosed a little sketch indicating the exact situation. Longfellow told the story of the writing of Excelsior, and Whittier wrote something about the barefoot boy. Edward prized his collection of letters and autographs, which were not only interesting and valuable in themselves, but led to a number of real adventures that had a great influence on his life. He watched the newspapers to learn when the writers of his friendly letters were staying in New York, and ventured to call upon them. In one evening, he was able to talk with General Grant, Jefferson Davis, and Mrs. Abraham Lincoln. He spent a summer vacation in Boston, where he went to see the famous group of New England poets, Longfellow, Emerson, and Holmes. This was a time of high adventure for an ambitious boy who was working now as a stenographer in a publishing house and hoping someday to command success as an author or editor, which he did. You can read the details of how this unfolded for yourselves. Of special interest to this group is that he saw an unfulfilled need that needed to be met in writing to homemakers, and he became editor of the Ladies' Home Journal. At once he determined to take hold of the work as a new adventure and make of the magazine something that would be really worthwhile. I must discover what the readers of the journal want, and then give them something in that line, but just a little bit better. Perhaps he remembered at this time his grandfather's adventure for beauty in his island home. When he planted the first trees there, he was giving the islanders something a little better than the things that they knew they wanted. This policy, we know in advance, made the magazine a success and also opened the door to new opportunities for adventure. Why is it that builders of small houses give no thought to what is beautiful or homelike? He said to himself, as he looked out a train window one day. Nature has given America a rich and beautiful land, but the people do not seem to care for beauty in their homes. He decided to offer prizes for the best plans for houses that would not cost more than $5,000. The winning plans were given a prominent place in the magazine, which also offered full descriptions and estimates so that any builder would be able to use the plans. In this way, thousands of people who were unable to pay for the services of an architect could secure well-planned and attractive homes. The magazine next went on a crusade for more beauty within the homes. Pictures were shown of well-planned rooms in contrast with furniture that was poorly chosen and arranged. The reader was told, "Look on this picture, and then on that." There could have been no better way of driving a point home. And by the way, he is credited with turning the parlor or drawing room into the living room. He wrote, "We have what is called a drawing room. Just whom or what it draws, I have never been able to see, unless it draws attention to too much money and no taste." His ideal was the wife as homemaker and child rearer, and children raised in a healthy, natural setting close to the soil. Sound familiar? Theodore Roosevelt said of Bach, "He is the only man I ever heard of who changed for the better the architecture of an entire nation, and he did it so quickly and effectively that we didn't know it was begun before it was finished." Other campaigns in behalf of beautiful America followed to make people realize the extent to which signs and billboards had been permitted to spoil the charm of the countryside. Again, pictures of the before and after sort told the story. Another series of pictures showed up, dirty cities, and while anger was aroused, together with threats to boycott the magazine, cleanup and paint-up drives became the order of the day in many places. These are only a few of the ways in which Edward Bach was able to make his work as editor a real service to the cause of beauty and better living for many. It was therefore a great surprise to his friends when, after 30 years of work with the magazine, the editor declared that it was time for him to retire. "You're not an old man," they said, "and you're not ill, are you? Why should you give up such successful work when you're only 56 years young?" "Because others are ready to carry on this work," was the reply, "and they should have a clear field. I too want the chance, while I am still young enough, to set out on a new trail. People spend many years in making a living, but often forget to take time to live," he added. It was soon evident that this citizen had only been waiting for the opportunity to do a number of interesting things. He wrote the story of his life, which is called The Americanization of Edward Bach, a Pulitzer Prize winner, by the way. He said that all of the events of the years since he came as a little boy to this country were adventures in the making of an American citizen. America had given him a chance to do worthwhile work, and he had been happy in the doing of it. He wished now to give to his adopted country some special service in return for the opportunities that he had enjoyed. He started awarding prizes to individuals who worked for the welfare and happiness of the city where he lived, which was Philadelphia, and later he set people to thinking of ways to achieve world peace. It was clear that Edward Bach was using his time and his money to good purpose. As we have seen, he was trying in different ways to show his gratitude to America for the opportunities that had been given him in this land. During the last years of his life, he was able to show his love for his adopted country by a wonderful gift to his fellow countrymen. The story of that gift had its beginning long ago in the making of a bleak island into a place of beauty and in the message which he felt had been sent to him to carry on that work. The Dutch boy who came to the New World never forgot the splendid adventure of his grandfather across the sea. Always as he went from one kind of work to another, he knew that he was adventuring for beauty. The great opportunity to make the thought of the Island of Nightingales take root and blossom in America came to Edward Bach while he was on a vacation in Florida. He chanced one day to see the bodies of some songbirds lying near the beach. Many birds that are migrating from the north to Cuba or South America lose their lives here every year, he was told. Often when they are caught in a storm, their strength does not hold out for the long journey that they make every spring and autumn. In a flash, then, Edward Bach remembered the storm-driven birds that had found a refuge among the trees of the Island of the Nightingales. Now he knew that he must make an island of rest and safety for tired birds and people in America. It should be a place of beauty and peace where many in need of renewal of strength and joy could come. In the center of Florida, about midway between the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean, is a place 324 feet above sea level, the highest ground in the state. This stretch of land, barren save for a growth of noble pine trees, Edward Bach selected for his island of beauty. A year was spent in providing the needed system for ensuring a supply of water. Trenches were dug and pipes laid. Then a landscape architect began to transplant to the high ground trees and bushes that grew in abundance in nearby swampy districts. Bushes with berries for the birds and underbrush for shelter were planted. Among the trees that were introduced were the dogwood, magnolia, live oak, wild plum, and mulberry. There were also masses of feathery golden acacia, hundreds of brilliant azalea plants, and everywhere the Florida blueberry bushes making a soft background with their dull gray-green foliage. Two lakes were dug and surrounded with lilies and iris. Here wood ducks, herons, and flamingos were made welcome. A dozen nightingales were brought from England to found a colony in this bird paradise. In the midst of nature's gifts, rising more than 200 feet from the hilltop, is a lovely singing tower. The base is made of the Florida coquina rock. Above this, built of pink Georgia marble, is the tower, which holds a wonderful carillon of 61 bells. The name Singing Tower comes from Old World times, when the people of Belgium and Holland built watchtowers from which sentinels could look out over the land and give warning of a break in the dikes or of danger from an enemy. A horn was blown in time of need as a signal from the watchers. Later on, bells placed in the tower sounded instead of the horn. In the 17th century, famous carillons of bells pealed with the passing of the hours. The music of the bells that Edward Bach had heard as a child echoed in his memory with the quaint stories of long ago times. That is the reason it came to pass that a singing tower was built in the heart of a bird sanctuary at Mountain Park, Florida. The bells from the towers are played at sunset each day and at noon on Sundays. At the entrance to this place of beauty is placed this sign: "The sanctuary for the humans and the birds. I come here to find myself. It is so easy to get lost in the world." In January 1930, when Edward Bach came to the end of his earthly journey, his body was laid to rest in a crypt under the Singing Tower. The last of his adventures for beauty led to this sanctuary, where we may hear echoed in the songs of birds and of pealing bells the message, "Make you the world a bit more beautiful and better because you have been in it." And I have just added another place I want to visit before I die. Carillon recitals are still offered daily, and the Singing Tower houses the largest carillon library in the world. I absolutely love listening to carillon bells. Who wants to join me? Bye-bye. See you next time.